The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, our affiliate stations, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm on location in Toronto. Through the wonders of science and technology, Mike Harrison and Jean Ouimet are back in the studio, ensuring that I can continue to multitask like nobody's business. So on my last trip to the drugstore, I noticed that among the cold remedies and the cough drops were things that I wouldn't exactly consider medicine. Things like homeopathic headache pills, detox diets, supplements. And I started thinking about how these things get on the shelf in the first place. And then I was wondering how pharmacists feel about all this. And then I remembered that I host a radio show. So on today's episode, we'll be live with pharmacist Scott Gavura. And while I was thinking about drugstores and pharmacists and such, Anthony was thinking about ants. Yes, everyone, it's time for a visit from Brownie in Motion.
Hey, welcome back, Anthony.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I notice you're no longer using my nom de radio.
You know, I decided that was silly. Everyone already knows who you are.
That's good. Hi, everybody. I am Brownian, and I am Anthony. I'm all of these and above. But yes, okay, so ants. I was going to talk about pharmacological things as well, but then I decided ants seemed more interesting since Scott would certainly have more to say on it than I would. But what I wanted to talk about particularly are, more than ants, are two particular myrmecologists that study them. But first of all, the reason that I find this interesting is I've always liked ants. For whatever reason, I think they're fascinating insects. They look cool. They've got a myriad of designs and forms and shapes and all sorts of different ecological niches, and they do all kinds of different things. So they are one of the great success stories. They've been around for since the Cretaceous. And they occupy keystone positions pretty well all over the world in most ecosystems. In fact, they're usually the mover and shakers of most ecosystems. And there's at least tens of thousands of species of them separated into almost 300 genera and 21 subfamilies. But so in researching and looking into this, I came across, and actually it was through an old Discover magazine that I had. I'd read about this individual named Brian Fisher, who's a curator of entomology at the California Academy of Sciences. And this guy's the Indiana Jones of myrmecologists, in the sense that he's done most of his work in Africa and Madagascar, and he's got all sorts of stories about, you know, having to climb on the back of buses, completely riddled with parasites. He himself, after having spent weeks and weeks and weeks in the field, you know, hitching rides, lying to customs officials, bribing his way onto planes and things like that, and you know, just even reading some of his story, all you get is this Indiana Jones sense. But what he's really big on is bringing this study. Well, one of the things that he was troubled by was that the problem with entomology is that everybody's got these type species, these little insects stuck on pins sitting in a museum somewhere, where taxonomists look over them or theoretically should be. But what really happens is they end up sitting there in some glass case in the back of a museum, unlooked at in some back room for hundreds of years. Well, or, you know, decades at the very least. And so he was the pioneer and founder of a website called antweb.org, which is a website that allows pretty well anybody to research ants, see all kinds of beautiful pictures of them, really, really detailed ones, know something about their life habits, put them on maps, understand how they fit into their ecosystem, see the research on that. And his interest in doing this is in democratizing science, something that I've talked about before that I find really fascinating too, bringing this information out so it's accessible to everybody and allowing them to interact and potentially add to the body of knowledge that we have about these particular insects. So AntWeb is this, like I said, it's a big catalog What the eventual goal is to have the entire sum of knowledge of every species that we know about of ants cataloged, archived, and placed on this website in a way that everybody can possibly study it. Everybody can see the photos. In fact, it's got all kinds of great tools. You can, if you've got Google Earth, which I should assume everybody should have, just because it's such a great resource, you can overlay. You can put ant overlays on them and see where particular species are, where they're located, where their type species are, what ecosystems they interact with, and that you can if you're interested in their taxonomic information, you can research that for every species they've got. They've got all of those information. You can compare images, and you can even print off handy field guides if you want to go studying out in your field at any time as well. So you can print off.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
Why would we need to have location based access to the diversity and wonder of ants? Why would we want to know by location specifically?
Well, for a number of reasons. One is to see how. I mean, the field of biogeography studies exactly that. How are particular species integral to their specific ecosystems? What do they do? How do they interact with the other things around you or in some other location? You might also be interested in looking at threatened ecosystems and what happens when ecosystems are changed. For instance, fire ants. And I'll talk about them a little bit later, but fire ants are fairly common in Florida, but they're an invasive species from South America. And what it turns out is that they're really, really well adapted to disturbances in the ecosystem. So at first it was thought that they just basically outcompeted all the other species. But what happens is the endemic species, which are a little bit less able to deal with ecological disturbances caused by usually humans, whereas fire ants easily will be able to take over. But fundamentally, as well, like even from a personal perspective, you might just be interested in knowing what things are around in your local area, much in the same way that bird watchers might be interested in bird watching as well and would pick up specific guides to their localities.
See, that's interesting because my first thought in regards to that was my own preservation. I thought it possibly had something to do with the fact that you could check to make sure that the one that bit you wasn't poisonous.
Well, all ants are poisonous to some degree, but none of them are likely to kill you. So,
really? None?
That might be. I suppose the army ants and the foraging ones, I guess they could probably do that, but they're not going to kill you with toxins. They're just going to swarm you with numbers. But having said that, fire ants, and I've had a few experiences with fire ants, they can deal a pretty painful bite, and especially if you get a whole handful of them swarming all over you, if you happen to be wearing flip-flops or anything like that. Yeah, that kind of sucks. So that's not a bad idea.
Well, speaking about the bites, before the show you were actually mentioning the Schmidt Sting Pain Index, I believe it was.
Yeah, I was looking that up because I had an experience with fire ants when I was very young, and I was vacationing with my parents in Hawaii, and we were barbecuing on the beach, and we happened to get attacked by, unbeknownst to us, a swarm of fire ants had taken up residence in this particular brick barbecue on the beach that we were using. So as soon as we fired it up and started cooking whatever it was that we were cooking, they came out and voiced their displeasure, as it were, in their own little way. It turns out fire ants aren't nearly the most painful. Harvester ants, which are really, really common in Florida, elsewhere and that, but are usually fairly docile, have a fairly painful sting. But anybody who's interested in ants and that might have seen videos of the bullet ant, which are ants that live, I can't remember, somewhere in South America, and in fact are used in rituals by some of the local tribes, where people will build these, they'll make these great woven thatched gloves and embed the ants in them, stingers facing in, and then as a manhood rite of passage ritual, will allow themselves to be stung, and they're aptly named bullet ants because essentially it feels like being shot by a bullet.
Lovely. Cultures are neat.
Yeah, and crazy. We're all crazy.
that was the one I wasn't going to say. But the Schmidt Sting Pain Index. How do they research that? Because from my understanding, it's an index that says what hurts less or more, and the specific kind of pain involved with different stings.
I'm I'm not actually sure how they did that, but I can. My best guess, and one that I suspect is probably true, is they tested it out personally by going, what hurts more, this? Ow! Or this? Ow!
And that's what I was wondering about. That has to be the worst study to be involved in ever.
Well, and the reason that's most likely how they did that is because it's from a neurological perspective, pain is still not all that well understood. And if you look up Schmidt's pain index, you'll see there are a number of other pain indexes, a few more dealing with particular Hymenoptera and other insect groups, but as well trying to measure pain in hospitals is another big one. And basically, the best we can do is just ask people to self-report how they feel and do that over and over and over again to get some measure of what pain actually means to people, and it's fairly subjective. So that's why I say that's my best guess that's exactly what they did with the Schmidt's pain index.
Pain tests. That's what grad pain students tests. Are
that,
for.
That's what grad students and postdocs.
And on that note, thanks very much, Anthony, for being on the show today.
All right. Thank you, Desiree. And then enjoy Toronto.
Thank you. I will. I am. Listeners, if you want to appear on Skeptically Speaking to talk about whatever your little skeptical or scientific heart desires, do send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line. Give us just a quick idea of whatever you'd like to talk about, and we'll contact you. And for all of you out there that plan to act as spokespeople for your own local skeptical groups, this is a very, very good way to get some media practice in with a very sympathetic and mostly friendly interviewer. Just saying. And we'll be right back to talk with pharmacist Scott Gavura about drugstores, drugs, things that aren't really drugs, and people that aren't really doctors right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Hello, all. You're back with Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today, we're playing Ask a Pharmacist with Scott Gavura. It's time for all those questions you've had about generic versus brand name medications, whether pharmacists can say no to filling your prescriptions, and whether that Viagra that you bought online is the cause of that weird lump. Scott, who's with us tonight, is the director of the provincial drug reimbursement program at Cancer Care Ontario. And prior to that, he was the director of the Drug Information and Research Center at the Ontario Pharmacists Association, where he led a team of pharmacists to support appropriate drug use, deliver pharmacist education, and enhance the role of pharmacists in the healthcare system. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Pharmacy and a Master's of Business Admin from the University of Toronto, and he's currently running for the Board of Directors for the Canadian Pharmacists Association, which is the national voluntary organization of pharmacists committing to advancing the profession of pharmacy so as to contribute to the health of Canadians. And he's also the guy behind the science-based pharmacy blog, where he writes about pharmacy practice, questionable science, and evidence-based healthcare. So thanks so much for being here, Scott.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
So your blog is called Science-Based Pharmacy, which was actually kind of surprising to me, because to the best of my knowledge, being a pharmacist is a science-based profession. Are there issues that the public isn't aware of?
It's a great question. Let me just start by saying, if you don't mind, just that anything that I say is in no way should be taken to reflect the views of Cancer Care Ontario, any past employer, any organization I work for, any organization I'm associated with. So I just want to get that out there up front.
Liability issues aside. Hey, Scott.
Let me answer that by just stepping back, if I can describe briefly kind of how pharmacy came to be and where I think it's going. I think that'll tie into kind of my motivation around the blog. So pharmacy started as a profession in the year 1231. Frederick II of Germany decided that pharmacy and medicine should be two separate professions, each with their own skills and responsibility, and he issued an edict that said the person who writes the prescriptions is not the person who's going to fill the prescriptions. And he drew a clear line between the two professions, and basically, in exchange for the provisions of products and services, pharmacists were granted exclusivity to dispense medications. And over the resulting centuries and decades, the pharmacy is now a self-regulated health profession. It's no longer a technical role. The pharmacist doesn't make the drugs in the pharmacy. It's one that's more patient-focused, and the pharmacist is now responsible for really helping to work with other health professionals to solve drug-related problems. So you become a pharmacist after 5 or more years of university undergraduate training and often postgraduate work, and training is rooted in basic and applied sciences. You know, and among the health professionals, it's only pharmacy is devoted to really optimizing the use of medications. So it's my personal opinion that the privileges that pharmacists have in society are increasingly being misused, I guess, through the growing availability of more questionable and even potentially dangerous products and services. And so the blog was really started to focus on pharmacy practice and the sale of questionable products. And I started to initially look at the over-the-counter products, the ones that you see on the shelves, but I've looked at some prescription drugs as well. And I think my concern is that pharmacy owners are increasingly counting on the sale of these products. And I think that that's limiting the profession of pharmacy as it tries to move forward into evidence-based care and professional services and optimizing patient care. It's really holding the pharmacy back as a retailer, and I think that's what's concerning to me.
Oh, that's actually really interesting. So there's actual opposition to science-based pharmacy?
Well, I wouldn't say that there's direct opposition, but I think there's a few factors that come into play. Fewer and fewer pharmacies are truly independent and actually owned by pharmacists anymore. So if you look at the major chains like the Shoppers Drug Mart or Rexall or any of the ones that may be located in grocery stores or other retailers, those stores are the product listing decisions are often no longer made by pharmacists. So they're made by marketers in the head office or elsewhere. So the pharmacist behind the counter may have very little to no influence in terms of what's being sold. Increasingly, there's significant pressure on prescription drug costs and pharmacist fees, and the sales of the products in front of the counter offset some of the pharmacy costs. So, and they're often, you know, the other thing that we keep in mind is these products are sought after by patients, and so they drive traffic into the store. So, so I would say no, there's not direct opposition, but there's certainly a lot of interest to keep in mind.
Listeners, if you'd like to talk to a real live pharmacist, do call 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email live@skepticallyspeaking.com or we're on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So then, Scott, what kind of standards actually exist for things sold in a pharmacy? Because it seems to me that there's a whole lot of, you know, not exactly evidence-based stuff for sale in a place that's actually called a drugstore.
It's a good question. Do you want to talk about behind the counter or in front of the counter? There's completely different standards, really, when you go behind the counter, the prescription drugs, compared to what's in front of the counter.
Let's start and just touch on briefly behind the counter, but I'm actually more interested in the rest of the stuff that gets sold that anybody can go and pick up.
Yeah, okay. So all prescription drugs have to meet very strict standards for safety and efficacy, and drugs can only be sold in Canada after Health Canada has approved hundreds and hundreds of volumes of safety data and efficacy data. And it's a very similar process to what's followed by the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S., very similar. So there's a Food and Drugs Act in Canada and Food and Drug Regulations, and those acts and regulations apply to prescription drugs, but also the non-prescription products you might see, like the cough and cold products as well. But when we move in front of the counter, there's completely different requirements for what are called the natural health products, which include items like homeopathy. Anything that's considered to be a natural health product is not subject to the same standards that are being held for prescription drugs. It's still Health Canada, but it's a natural health products directorate is responsible for that, and it's a completely different standard. So when you look at a lot of the products on the shelves in front of the pharmacist counter, it's really a mixed bag. So if there's some typical non-prescription drugs like the cough and cold products may be safe and effective. They may be considered drugs, but they may be right beside herbal remedies or homeopathy, which are subject to completely different standards.
So are there any efforts being made to actually create equitable standards between those kind of products at all? Or
Yes. In Canada, the food and drug regulations are largely unchanged since the 20s. And I think there's recognition now that we need to, with respect to prescription drugs, continually evaluate safety. A lot of drugs, you've probably seen in the past several years, drugs being withdrawn, Vioxx for one. And it means that we need to provide more scrutiny on drugs once they're licensed for sale. So these are the prescription drugs. So there was a new model that was proposed a few years ago. It's called progressive licensing, and it was brought forward as a means of modernizing how we review and how these drugs are approved. And that was actually Bill C-51. Now, Bill C-51 may be known to listeners really because of the impact on natural health products. And the natural health product regulations came into effect in 2004, and they sought to impose some sort of a standard on herbals and traditional medicines, because I think there was recognition that herbal products will never be able to meet prescription standards for safety or efficacy. So at a minimum, they really try to ensure that at least what's on the label is in the bottle. So recognizing that these products are sought after.
Right.
So Bill C-51 included significantly increased penalties for natural health product manufacturers who fail to adhere to basic standards. And Bill C-51 died in 2008 with the dissolution of government. So it hasn't yet been reintroduced. Now, there are the existing regulations for natural health products, and all products are supposed to comply with the regulations by 2010, but there's no evidence yet that even a fraction of them do yet. You'll know if they are approved and have been reviewed by Health Canada because they'll have a NPN number on it, which is natural product number.
Okay. Now, I don't know if you can answer this question. I don't know if there's a pharmacist code or anything, but is there like a least effective thing that you would say that's sold in a pharmacy?
Prescription or non-prescription?
Non-prescription.
Non-prescription? I would say homeopathy has got to be in terms of the least effective. You've got an elaborate placebo system that's been given tacit blessing by pharmacy. Because there's no active ingredient in these products. So I would say that's probably the least effective. I think what's probably the most concerning to me are adulterated natural health products. And some companies have been repeatedly cited by Health Canada for selling natural remedies that are actually adulterated with real drugs. And yet these companies continue to operate and they continue to sell their products in pharmacies. So it's unfortunate, but regulators really seem unable to keep companies from existing and selling products that are adulterated.
Well, can you give us an example of those?
There's been, if you look through the Health Canada warnings, it's pretty easy to see the trend is that there's a lot of drugs that are sold over the counter for erectile dysfunction, which often end up containing real drugs like Viagra in them. So right. They're sold as herbal remedies, but they're really just adulterated with active ingredient.
Now, how about something like kids' cold medicine? I've been thinking about this. Now, does that fall into actual medicine, or does that fall into something that's not necessarily exactly natural health product, but something that's more like placebo?
Well, kids' cold medications have been on the market for decades, and they're not, I wouldn't say that they're a true placebo because there is active ingredient in them, but there's not a lot of evidence they work. And the kids, there's only a handful of actual chemicals in the different kids' cough and cold products, and they were approved for sale long before really solid clinical data was required. And there's really little data that ever looked at these drugs in kids. And it's not clear that they really have a lot of effectiveness. And while most kids don't have any problems taking them, sometimes very rare, very fatal side effects can occur. And the risks seem to be greater in younger children, particularly in infants. And so, you know, colds are generally mild and they go away on their own, and there's no product that's been demonstrated to actually shorten the duration of your cold. So, you know, unless evidence emerges to show that the drugs are really effective, there's really not a lot of benefit to them. Now, Health Canada has indicated that by the end of 2009 that cough and cold products will no longer be labeled for sale for children under the age of 6. So, and that's consistent with what we're seeing in Australia and the United Kingdom, I believe, and the United States as well. So I think there's finally some recognition that these drugs really don't provide any benefit. They definitely offer some harm to patients in some circumstances, so it's better to not provide them.
Okay, well, now if somebody came into the drugstore and they ask you for information about one of these not exactly evidence-based kind of remedies, what would you say? And would what you say be different if they asked you about homeopathy versus if they asked you about something like kids' cold remedy?
Well, it's difficult. So if I'm working as a relief pharmacy in a store, it's not my goal to drive patients out of the store by telling them that none of the products work. So I want to engage the patient, and I want to make sure that they get products that are helpful to them, or at least provide them with advice that's helpful to them. So in the case of homeopathy, I'll indicate to people to patients that there's generally not any evidence that it does work. I'll tell them that patients do report that it works, but it may be due to a placebo effect, and there isn't really a good efficacy that it does work. And if they're seeking something for a cough and cold for their children, I might talk about, you know, that they could use Tylenol, and they could use different types of basic cold management things like humidifying the room and things like that to manage the cold. But cough and cold products really shouldn't be expected to do a whole lot in their young child. But, you know, parents want something. I think when they've made the decision to come into the pharmacy, they want to leave with something. And so if they're not buying a product and they're in there and they're determined to buy a product, at least I try to give them some good information that they can act on.
So, audience, if you have a question about crappy things that maybe shouldn't be sold in pharmacies but are, do call 780-492-2577, extension 1. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So, let's go in a different direction. In Canada, can we actually fill our prescriptions online?
Yes. I'm not sure why you would want to. You generally would need to provide a copy of the prescription, so you'd need to mail it. And in preparation for the show, I took a look at a few Canadian pharmacies, and I was looking at generic drugs, and I found that the price was actually higher than what you'd find in a pharmacy if you walked in, because I think they're pricing their product for the American market. I would say for Canadians, it's probably not worth the hassle. But it is available.
We actually have a call on the line. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, hi. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. I've just been listening and hearing some of the comments made about homeopathic medicine, that it doesn't really work. We only have ever used homeopathic medicine, and some of it is very, very wonderful medicine. Natives use it as well. They're quite well acquainted with natural medicine. They find that it works. Many cultures around the world find success with natural homeopathic medicines. So I think it has a lot to do with the diet you may be on, whether or not it works within the body. We're vegetarians. We don't have a problem with natural medicines. But from my understanding, if other people on a non-vegetarian diet may experience not being able to absorb natural homeopathic medicine.
Scott, how would you respond, Scott?
Well, I just have a question for the caller. I'm not sure if I understand what you're speaking about. Are you talking about homeopathy, or are you talking about natural medicines? Because I don't consider...
I'm talking about both, and I'm including also Ayurvedic. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Yeah. Yeah,
they are all quite functional and very useful. They all work, but it depends what your body is made up of, how they act on the body. For example, if you're taking tons of calcium and your body is sick to begin with, you're wasting your money and your energy because the calcium won't be absorbed by the body. So it's a science.
Okay.
It's not just some kind of fortune-telling thing, homeopathic medicine. It's a science.
Well, thanks very much, caller. Now, while Scott answers, we're going to get somebody else on the line.
There are also hundreds of books on the market about homeopathic medicine.
Interesting thing when we look at homeopathy is that it's been studied in a lot of clinical trials, and what we find is the better the quality of the trial in terms of the rigor of the trial, the quality of the design, that it's placebo-controlled, that it's double-blind, there really isn't any good evidence to demonstrate that homeopathy works any better than a comparable placebo. And consequently, and that's exactly what we would expect, given that there's no active ingredient in homeopathy. So I don't doubt that your caller's getting better, and that certainly is the case. I mean, you can look at the placebo effects with some, even in drug trials that are looking at prescription drugs, and you can have a placebo response of 30-40%. In some cases, it's absolutely remarkable what the placebo effect can do. In the case of homeopathy, I mean, there's no active ingredients. There's no reason to expect there to be any physiologic response because there's no medicinal ingredient. Now, in the case of natural medicines, that's a different... I look at that as, if we're looking at herbals, then there's absolutely medicinal ingredients in there, and there's absolutely biochemical effects that can be measured. And I think from a pharmacy perspective, that's certainly the most interesting part of the natural medicines is the natural medicines, the herbal remedies themselves.
We have another caller on the line. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, caller.
Now, you had said that pharmacists today no longer operate their own pharmacies. Now, I would think that there should be some kind of laws in place that once you operate what's called a pharmacy, that you have to operate under certain conditions and some sort of governing bodies and in the auspices of responsible, you know, providing medical advice and all that kind of stuff. So once they take the pharmacist out of the operating equation and put that in the hands of the marketers and the corporations, as you say, who oversees this kind of stuff? Because, I mean, a bunch of marketers are putting in homeopathic and naturopathic remedies right next to legitimate medicines. I mean, that could be kind of dangerous. And so who's looking out, I guess, in terms of government?
That's a great question. I just want to clarify that the with respect to we have to look at the ownership is one piece. Certainly, the responsibility for the management of the pharmacy itself, which is the portion of the store that dispenses the prescriptions, is under the responsibility of a pharmacist and a pharmacist manager, and that's the case whether the actual store itself is owned by a corporation or a chain of some sort. So the actual responsibility for the ownership of the pharmacy is or the management of the pharmacy in terms of the operation of the pharmacy is still driven by pharmacists, and that's responsibility. Now, that may vary by state to state. In some, I believe there's at least one state in the U.S. that pharmacists still are required to own their only pharmacists can own pharmacies. The issue that I'm concerned with is the products that are sold in the front shop, which is the rest of the store, and that increasingly the decisions that are made around what are sold in the pharmacy are not being done by the pharmacist. So you may have a staff pharmacist who's simply an employee of the store. They don't have the opportunity to shape or determine the specific products that are on the shelves.
Thanks very much for calling. So let's go back to the online prescriptions. What about the things like the cheap generic drugs websites, the ones that offer drugs that aren't available in Canada? Are they actually illegal, or are they just, really sketchy looking?
That's another great question. I think that our good name as a for our healthcare system is increasingly being tarnished by organizations that are running pharmacies all over the world and calling them Canadian pharmacy to build on our good reputation. I saw one report that a Russian company was sending up to 60 billion email messages a day for a pharmacy called Canadian Pharmacy, and they operate hundreds of websites. There's no doctors involved, no prescription required, no fixed address. There's no connection with Canada at all. You might get drugs. You might get contaminated products. You might get placebos. It's interesting to note that in a couple of years ago, a woman in British Columbia died because she was slowly poisoned by pills that were laced with heavy metals, and she'd been purchasing drugs over the internet.
So should you just never buy drugs on the internet? Is that the way to protect yourself?
If you want to buy online, I think it's important to verify that the pharmacy is legitimate, that they have a mailing address, and they're a registered pharmacy in the province or state that you're dealing with. There's a website called Canadian International Pharmacists Association. Their website is CIPARX.ca. It's one site that accredits Canadian pharmacies, and you can go and see, and they provide a list of pharmacies that deal internationally that are accredited in their state. But you really do need to do your homework if you're going to deal with an internet pharmacy. As I said, for Canadians, I really don't see the merit in it. In most cases, your local pharmacy or a pharmacy you want to deal with will ship you your prescriptions, even if they're not a formal internet pharmacy.
Okay, now let's talk about something that that possibly will get angry phone calls. Let's talk about naturopaths. Recently in BC, naturopaths requested and won the right to prescribe medications. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. My understanding is that due to some reclassification of what were considered drugs or not considered drugs, that naturopaths lost access to lost the ability to access products that they'd previously been able to recommend. So they requested prescribing authority to access those products. And I don't think anyone had any big concern with this. Even the British Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons was supportive, but the naturopaths actually requested and won very broad prescribing authority for almost all drugs that were previously currently restricted really basically to physicians.
So why was that same proposal rejected in Ontario?
Yeah, in Ontario, it's interesting. An advisory council to the Ontario government recommended a significant expansion of scope of practice for naturopaths, including the right to prescribe drugs. This council had long been, a fairly uncritical acceptor of pseudoscience, accepting implausible concepts like ki and acupuncture. That the proposal was given to the Ontario government, but actually declined by the Ontario government. So they have not recommended to proceed with granting prescribing privileges for naturopaths in Ontario.
So, what would you say is the danger here, or is there a danger?
Well, I think that what's concerning to me, and I think to other science-based, evidence-based health professionals, is that. Health professionals like pharmacists, nurses, registered dietitians, physiotherapists, we play out of the same playbook in terms of the evidence base that we use. We take undergraduate courses. We'll sometimes take courses together. We work in hospitals together as part of our undergraduate training. And so our training is fairly consistent in terms of, you know, adherence to evidence-based guidelines and clinical practice. And when we look at the naturopath belief and the training is fairly, quite substantially different than science-based, evidence-based health professionals. It includes training in homeopathy, acupuncture. The naturopath's beliefs center around the idea of a vitalism, this idea that our biology doesn't adhere to physical and chemical scientific principles. And there's a belief in this healing power of nature, but it was just really just magical thinking. And there the claims that are made by naturopaths are really not supported by science in the vast majority of cases. And they're, you know, really unknown to, I guess, the rest of the science-based health professionals. So they use concepts like toxins and detoxification and colonic irrigation, homeopathy, food allergies, which aren't picked up by other health professionals, acid-base balance, stuff that's been rejected by science as unproven. So I think that's the concern that we have.
All right. Well, we'll be right back with more on the responsibilities of pharmacists. We'll be right back.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking with Daniel Loxton, the editor of Junior Skeptic Magazine, about skeptical education. If children are indeed the future, how can we help them to think critically about the world around them? How do we instill lifelong curiosity and a love of learning? Are there things that we can do to ensure that the next generation is thoroughly prepared for all the irrationality, pseudoscience, and disinformation that the world will throw at them? Find out on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR. Do it for the kids.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're actually on location in Toronto with pharmacist Scott Gavura, who's answering all of your pharmacy-related questions. Before we get back to the interview, though, I have a couple of announcements. So for all you Western Australians listening, there's a new skeptical group, the Perth Skeptics in the Pub. They are still getting going, it looks like, but they do plan to meet once a month at the Flying Scotsman in Mount Lawley. And I have no idea where those places are, but I'm sure they're lovely. So for more information, check out their blog at perthskeptics.org. There's actually a new skeptical resource in existence, the Grassroots Skeptics website, helping local skeptics groups share resources and strategies since sometime last month. They're just getting going, but they already have a fantastic looking events calendar up that they created with skeptic.org. So visit them at grassrootsskeptics.org. And if anyone out in audience land has an event that they'd like announced on Skeptically Speaking, just send us an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com and throw event in the subject line. That's the word, event. And one last thing. A while back, we received a lovely email from Kernan, who had the suggestion to add a question box to our website that would enable people to more easily email questions for each week's show. And we listen to our audience. It's been done. In fact, we redesigned the whole site. That's what happens when you give us suggestions. So everybody should go look at the site right now. There's a ton of new features. Go check it out at skepticallyspeaking.com. And many, many, many thanks to our technical producer, Josh, for all the hours of work he put into it. And thanks again to Kernan for the idea. So now back to pharmacist Scott Gavura. So Scott, how much say do pharmacists actually have in dispensing medication?
That's a great question. Pharmacists have primary responsibility to patients' well-being as a priority. So we're permitted, and it's actually a responsibility to use our professional judgment when filling a prescription. So that could include even declining to fill a prescription.
Interesting. So what circumstances could they say no in?
Well, it's not that common, but pharmacies are in the business of filling prescriptions, not refusing to fill them, but we're permitted and in some provinces compensated for not filling. So for reasons like allergies, duplicate drugs, the dose being too high or too low, potential abuse, suspicion of a forged prescription, or a drug that's conflicting or interacting with another drug.
Oh, okay. So good. So if a pharmacist notices that a doctor has prescribed two conflicting meds, then they can refuse to fill.
Yeah. Actually, I think if a pharmacist knowingly filled the prescription and the patient was harmed, the pharmacist could be held liable for that.
Oh,
so
good.
So it's a professional responsibility to catch that.
Okay. I believe we actually have an email. Is that correct?
Yeah, we do. It actually relates quite well to liability. I'll just jump right into it here. Big thanks to you for mentioning the natural health products and medical standards are different. Many people don't know this, and I'm always thrilled when that point is made. As somebody who was nearly killed by taking NHPs when the labels didn't match the contents, I'm very sad that Bill C-51 died. I've been working with Health Canada and speaking to pharmacy and medical students about my ordeal for years. I was curious, does Scott know that pharmacists can actually be held liable when they recommend a natural health product, and that the consumer has if the consumer has an adverse reaction? Although many pharmacists don't have a say as to what's on their shelves, as Scott mentioned, they should be able to refuse to sell something that they aren't convinced is safe. Do pharmacists ever refuse to sell NHPs? So I know some of that was covered in the previous statement, but I think the last point still stands as an open question.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for all pharmacists. Certainly what I tell patients when I'm speaking about natural health products is I tell them, one, that natural health products are poorly regulated, and consequently we don't have good information about or guarantees that what's on the label is what's in the bottle, and so I'll typically recommend specific brands that I'm more comfortable with. And then I'll also caution that the amount of information we have about NHPs is significantly less than what we have about prescription drugs. So we don't know about drug interactions in some cases. We don't know. There's so many more questions that we have about NHPs than we do about prescription drugs. And so I will always, when I'm speaking with patients who are buying those products, warn them about that.
So what rights do pharmacists have in regards to their moral or religious convictions? In some places they can refuse to fill because of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. I would have to say it's not a burning issue that I would say within the province. There have been some cases, and so I guess in terms of the rights pharmacists have varies based on province or state. So in Ontario, where I'm licensed, the pharmacist can decline to fill a prescription for this reason. The process that's required by our college is that they must indicate this to the manager or to the owner. They're not to tell the patient, and the pharmacist must ensure that there's an alternate source exists, and the patient is not allowed to be in should not be inconvenienced. Now, British Columbia has a similar rule, but they go even further. British Columbia indicates that if pharmacists have these beliefs, that they have to indicate this before they start their employment to facilitate planning. Yeah, and the manager must provide reasonable accommodation. But if alternative means are not available, then the pharmacist has a duty to provide the medication. Now, in the United States, it varies, I guess, with some states limiting pharmacists' rights to refuse and some of them affirming these rights.
So that sounds really vague, though, because what does, you know, alternate means mean?
Well, I think in the ideal situation would be another pharmacist in the pharmacy who's available to dispense medication. I think that a less desirable opportunity would be referring a patient to another pharmacy.
Okay, and this actually was the problem in the U.S. with rural communities.
Yes.
So there's only one pharmacist sometimes.
Yep. Yeah, and that, I think that is, there have been a few isolated cases in Canada. I'm not aware of it being a big issue in Canada. I know that has occurred in the States where there have been some significant problems that have occurred. And as a result, different states have responded in different ways related to the pharmacist's responsibility.
Okay, now I'm wondering, let's just stick actually with ethics for a moment. Is there any difference between brand name drugs and the generic version? I consider that an ethical question.
I don't think of that as an ethical question at all. I'd say no. Generic drugs are approved by Health Canada or the FDA, and they're approved on the basis that they're compared to the brand name version. So there might be slight differences in the way that the product looks, but there's no reason to think there's any difference between brand and generic. And I think to ask any pharmacist, they'll probably tell you that they use the generic versions themselves.
Interesting.
In most provinces, actually, pharmacists have the right and actually the responsibility to dispense the generic version because governments and insurance companies that are paying for the prescriptions will only pay the generic price once the generic's available. So the pharmacist is essentially forced to substitute the generic for the brand product. You know, there's nothing magical about a branded product compared to the generic. It's a chemical packed in a capsule or tablet with some filler and color. And once the generic company can legally sell it, it's relatively straightforward to develop it in most cases.
So do pharmacists actually make more money selling the brand name ones?
No, they actually make a bit more money on the generic drugs, but this can vary. And this is because there's competition for shelf space in the pharmacy, as several companies may make the same equivalent generic drug, and they secure shelf space by providing allowances and rebates to pharmacies. Now, I'm just speaking about Ontario. I'm not familiar with how prescriptions are priced in the United States, but I believe it's similar across Canada.
Now, this is interesting because this is always the sort of statement that is made against big pharma and pharmacies. So how do pharmacists make a profit then?
So, well, let's say the pharmacy makes a profit. The pharmacist might be a salaried employee, so that might be straightforward for the pharmacist. But the prescription cost includes the drug cost, which is usually the actual acquisition cost. In Ontario, the pharmacy can mark it up slightly in terms of, so they might add 8%, and then they will add a dispensing fee. So that's the profit. It's fairly transparent, actually, on the label in terms of the components in Ontario. It's required to show the cost of the drug, the fee, and then the total cost.
Okay, again, audience, if you'd like to get in on this conversation, the number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet at Skeptical Radio. So pharmacy is a business, and that might not always align with the interests of consumers. So how are consumers protected?
Well, unlike other places where you may buy products, pharmacists are held to a code of ethics, and they're required to adhere to that. And pharmacy itself is, you know, it's a self-regulating profession. In cases where people feel that their interests were put behind commercial interests, they can and should complain. And pharmacists are required to account for their actions and behavior, and can be reprimanded and even have their licenses revoked. So I think in the vast majority of cases, pharmacists behave in very, very ethically, and do put their patient interests as first and foremost. I mean, that's why we became pharmacists.
All right, I have an email here about Big Pharma. It's from Kennedy in Vancouver. So he says, "I am guessing." Now, this was sent before the show. He says, "I am guessing that your guest will address the profit motive angle on the common big pharma conspiracy that goes something to the tune of, why would they try to cure diseases when they can keep selling drugs to address the symptoms? The answer I usually give goes something like, because as you have so rightly addressed, they are in the job of making a profit. It's a competitive market, and the company that makes a cure for disease X is going to put all the companies that are merely making drugs to treat the symptoms out of business, at least in that specific vein, faster than you can blink. The answers I get usually fall in the eye-rolling, you are such a slave to the man variety. But some clever folks, most of whom I love and respect dearly, have lately come up with an argument that makes a fair bit of sense to me. The short version, yeah, I know this is already a long question, goes something like this. But if the symptoms are where the demand for attention is highest, But if the symptoms are where the demand for attention is highest, as symptoms are the more immediate to sufferers, and the profit margin is higher because in many cases, Kennedy, this is a horrible sentence, I will mark you later. In many cases, the basic mechanics of dealing with a symptom is already largely understood. Isn't the business pressure to focus on that going to draw away from the incentive to find a cure?" Did that make any sense to you, Scott?
Wow. If that was a question, I think I take some exception to the fact that pharmaceuticals are directed at symptoms. I mean, the symptom is the manifestation of the disease. And I think if you're looking at cholesterol, like high cholesterol, there's no symptoms. The cholesterol is the marker that you're treating. In the case of treating cancer, the manifestation of the cancer is, you know, it might be fatigue. That cancer drugs are designed to kill the cancer. In the case of antibiotics are designed to treat the illness. I mean, I think if anything, you look at homeopathy. Homeopathy claims that it treats the symptoms. That's what they base their treatments on, is actually just look at the symptoms and treat it. If you have a headache due to a brain tumor, or a headache due to, you know, a hangover, if your symptoms are the same, the homeopathic treatment is going to be the same. I mean, I think that majority of pharmaceuticals are designed to actually treat the underlying illness. I think in cases where there are symptomatic treatments, it's because there hasn't been a cure found yet, or an actual, you know, way to treat the disease.
Okay. So as consumers, is there anything that we have to watch out for? Because this is not, it's not that pharmacists are a specific industry that we particularly have to be scared of. But is there anything that as consumers that we can watch out for in terms of if it looks sketchy? Is there anything that we can do to protect ourselves?
I think in terms of for having your prescription filled, I don't think there's any specific problems with any pharmacy that you're going to find in United States or Canada in terms of one that you might walk into. I mean, pharmacies are very tightly regulated and inspected. I think what I do recommend is that you should support pharmacies where if you have a prescription, the pharmacist provides you with good information in response to your questions. If you go up to the counter and you're looking for a product, that you get good advice. And you should support pharmacies that sell legitimate products and not be afraid to complain if you see quackery like homeopathy and detox kits on the shelf. You know, without the feedback, the pharmacies won't act. I'm doing my part, but I need all of you to help.
That was beautiful, Scott. And with that, we're actually out of time for today. So thank you so much to Scott for being our guest. And actually, audience, we're in Scott's house right now. He's been a very kind host. You should see all the wires all over this room. So if you like this episode, you can download it for your very own on iTunes. And maybe while you're waiting for the show to download, maybe you could also write a review of our program, perhaps. And maybe if you have time left, you could join our Facebook group. And then maybe head over to our new and improved website at skepticallyspeaking.com and comment on the show. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter. We're at Skeptical Radio, as always. And I think that's enough propaganda for tonight. That's it for now, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. Oh, the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie.
And everything you believe is a lie.